Okay, I guess we should move on anyway. This is a nice preface to the final talk from Mike Harfoot. Hopefully, Mike, you're still there. And
yeah, I'm still here. I'm nervous about
excellent.
I'm also following on from everybody else.
So, Mike, I believe you're based in Cambridge, and you have affiliations with UNEP and Microsoft. Is that right? And so you've been generating some models combining both land and sea. So that's a very perfect way to end the day, I think.
Great. I'm just trying to share my screen. Do you see it yet?
Okay. Yeah, something is coming. Yeah, that looks good. Yes.
Do you see the actual slide or the...
yes, we can see the actual slides and we can see you, so that looks good.
Okay, good. Thanks. Well, yeah, thanks indeed for the invitation to talk. It's obviously a great privilege to talk to you all. Yes, I'm very nervous to be wrapping up after all these amazing presentations with such a esteemed audience and with a clock ticking as well. So, I will get to it. I wanted to kick off with a very probably trivial statement, but that biodiversity is a complex concept, and the processes giving rise to it are also extremely complex. This is the case, or it has been the case, in the purely natural world. We've seen that in some of the historical talks we heard today, but it's also becoming more complex under the substantial array of unprecedented human drivers of change that we have in the present day. And so partly in face of that, we've been trying to develop sort of globally applicable and general mechanistic models of ecological systems. And I'm going to draw the analogy with climate models. So the climate system is also complex. But generally globally applicable models have been developing there for over 60 years. So starting back in 1956, potentially the first one was developed. And it was very simple. And so I'm going to caveat with what by saying I think we are still pretty good at my ecosystem models, which I'll talk about, was somewhere back in the 1950s or 60s.
Mike, we don't...
Oh, yeah. Well, you can't hear me very well.
The sound from your microphone sounds very weird.
The sound, okay, does it sound better if I lean forward? Oh, okay, my apologies. I'll try and stay a bit closer. I don't know how much of that you caught, but my analogy was that mechanistic models of the climate system have been developed for over 60 years, starting in the 1950s. But to caveat my talk, I'm going to suggest that general ecosystem models were still in the 1950s or 60s of model development. So it's very early days. But I think it's possible, and hopefully what I'll show will demonstrate that. So we published a paper back in 2014 describing the model concept. And so we wanted to develop a model, as we say, that was generally applicable across terrestrial and marine ecosystems, could be applied globally, either under individual grid cells or across a grid of cells. And we wanted them, we built the model on it using a grid-based structure, imposing realistic geography and environmental conditions. We drove the model basically with primary producers in a very simplistic way, very simplistic representation of primary producers. In some respects, we tried to use a sort of balanced level of complexity for those as we did for animals, for the heterotrophic organisms. But on land, we used a sort of semi-mechanistic, environmentally driven carbon cycle model. And in the oceans, we were using remotely sensed phytoplankton to drive a phytoplankton stock, which animals would eat from. And here's where I get really nervous after hearing all the amazing work other people have done, is that we basically took a whole load of ecology and threw it away to make some really huge abstractions compared to the real world. So we knew we wanted to specify the model at as close as we could to the level of individuals, because we think that's an important unit on which ecological processes act. But we also knew that we couldn't, and if we wanted the model to be generally applicable and globally applicable, it needed to be able to represent all organisms. And of course, we don't know a lot about many species on Earth, and we haven't described a huge set of them as well. So we decided to ignore taxonomy and focus on functional traits. And we chose a set of functional traits which we think reflected the fundamental ecological processes that organisms undergo. And so organisms in the model are, or we had an individual organism in the model that will be specified according to a set of categorical traits. So its trophic level, its metabolic pathway, whether it moves, and its reproductive strategy. And then a set of continuous traits, an adult body mass, which it becomes reproductively mature, and a juvenile model body mass, which is it's introduced into the model. And those are fixed over the lifetime of that individual. So they won't vary. And then at any point in time, that organism, its current body mass will be varying ontogenetically. But because of computational limitations, we can't model every individual globally in that way. And so we make this abstraction of grouping individuals together into what we call cohorts, which have essentially the same set of traits, except they also have an abundance of individuals at any point in time. And so these become the agents of the model on which the model operates, these cohorts of individuals specified as a set of categorical traits and then a set of continuous traits. And each of those cohorts undergoes this set of very simplistic compared to the real world ecological processes. So those cohorts metabolize following mass scaling and temperature scaling relationships, following the metabolic theory of ecology. They can be predated upon, and I'll speak a little bit more about that in a further slide. But the key point here is that we've got a transfer of individuals from the prey cohort into body mass of the predator happening during a predation event. The cohort could eat itself either from autotrophs or from other heterotrophs in the model, and that would result in an increase in the biomass of that cohort. If the cohort's successful in meeting its metabolic costs or exceeding its metabolic costs with food intake, then it could grow to reproductive maturity and then reproduce an offspring agent or cohort, which would inherit most of the same traits as the adult cohort in the model. There's some chance that the cohort might undergo mortality processes, either if it doesn't meet its metabolic costs through food intake or through old age. And then if we run the model in a spatially explicit manner, there's some chance the cohort might move from its current location to another location. And that movement probability is also determined by the body mass of the individuals that we talk about. And so what we tended to do is start the model off with a essentially a neutral assumption about what organisms, what cohorts are there in a given location. So we throw a load of organisms spanning quite a large range of the trait space into the model. And then we allow the model to integrate forward until it reaches some kind of quasi-stable state. And then we look at whether the model is doing something sensible. What we tend to have within any given grid cell in the model is on the order of thousands of cohorts, which are undergoing on the order of hundreds of thousands of interactions. And that can happen in a single grid cell, and then we have that happening in every grid cell that we run the model for across the spatial domain. And in this slide, I just illustrate, hopefully it works, what's happening to the dynamics of the model. So each of these, this is output from the model for 12 months. Each of these points represents a cohort in the model arranged across their current mass along the y-axis and their adult mass along the x-axis. So cohorts, as they go through time, they're growing up towards their adult mass. If we select any given cohort in this visualization, we'll see what it's being predated upon, the orange lines, and what it's predating upon itself. And that's changing dynamically as the prey individuals in the model change in body size themselves through time. So a quick visualization of some of the dynamics that's going on in the model in a single grid cell. Oops, I didn't mean to do that. Sorry. Okay, hopefully we're back again. So just to very quickly give you an insight into the some of the theory that's in behind the model. So it follows some very similar theoretical background as many of the marine ecosystem models, which actually have a very similar structure to the one that we have here. I think the real novelty of the Madini model is its application in the terrestrial realm as well as in the marine realm. But the model, the metabolism in the model is driven by, as I said, the metabolic theory of ecology, combined with some niche empirical information on metabolic niches to decide when organisms are active or not, depending on ambient conditions. The feeding relationships are models using Holling's type 3 functions. I'll come back to those again in a few slides' time. Again, here we're using predator-prey interactions are using body size preferences of predator for prey to modify the types of organisms which are being predated upon. And we drew that information from predator-prey interaction data of the like shown here from Ulrich Pro's earlier work. But basically on board the fact that that's not in individual level interactions. So I think there are some modifications we could incorporate there based on what we've seen today. After that very whistle-stop tour, where we got to was this, but essentially for me, this astonishing finding that if you put all that quite very simplified ecology compared to the real world together, the model can generate some quite a broad range of estimates, which seem to be quite plausible. And just to reemphasize, these are all estimates that are emergent from the model. So they're not in any way constrained directly by parameters that are fitted to data. And we could look at how the model makes predictions across a range of organizational scales. So at the individual level, we see the emergent growth rate compared here to the gray points are the model points and the black points in the empirical data, captures the log linear growth rate with body size relationship that we see in empirical data. The lifetime reproductive success of any given individual follows a similar central tendency, but with much greater variation in the model compared to empirical data. At the community scale, we see these negative log linear abundance body size relationships. When we look at the slope of those across a set of ecosystems, here shown in the red pots, for different trophic levels, green being herbivores, blue being omnivores, and red being carnivores, fit within the distribution of those same slopes quantified from, in this case, this is fisheries trawl catch data. And then more recent data, which I've been working on running the model at the global scale, only terrestrially, I'm afraid here, but calculating the functional richness of endothermic organisms in the model in the present day, given present day climatic and land use conditions. We can see there are some reasonable correlations, spatial correlations in terms of the patterns of functional richness in the model compared to empirically estimated richness from mammal range maps and functional trait databases. And then we saw this slide, Fabien mentioned this slide in his talk, which was really fascinating. But if we look at the model across some sort of multi-trophic structure in different ecosystems, we find that the model does pretty well in many locations, particularly in the marine environment. In the terrestrial environment, there's very strong evidence that the model is much more representative of savanna and grassland systems than it is of forest or desert type systems. And I'll come back to that later. We also found evidence for these top heavy biomass pyramids, or inverted from the standard biomass pyramids. And we found that dispersal of organisms played an important role in the spatial extent and the frequency of those. And also that the bottom-heavy biomass structure was more frequent when the turnover rate of phytoplankton was reduced, or the rate and efficiency of biomass transfer through the ecosystem was lower. And recent work, again, that's been published in the last year has been largely terrestrially focused on partly reflecting, I think, the novelty of the model there, where we haven't had an analogue to play with in the terrestrial realm. Both of these studies have been looking at what the effects, so the multitrophic effects might have been of removing large animals. So in the Hoeksical paper in 2020, we looked at the removal of large carnivores from the model and what happened, really running the model globally, what happened to ecosystem structure when you take out the largest predators from systems. And what we found there was this release of herbivores, which is consistent with this resource exploitation hypothesis, that the herbivores are generally top-down constrained. And that herbivore release, I beg your pardon, I'm not explaining the points. The purple points are representing a world where large carnivores are present, and the orange points are when we've removed carnivores above 21 kilograms. When we remove large carnivores, we see a release of herbivores, so their biomass increases, and the biomass of autotrophs is suppressed as a result of that release. On the right-hand side, we looked at what might happen if we removed large herbivores from ecosystems, simulating a change from the Holocene through to the present and then potentially into the future if herbivore declines continued. And we see that as we go from the black point, which is a megafaunally intact, megaherbivore intact ecosystems, through to purple, which is a present-day system, through to the future where we see all the threatened species in the present going extinct, that there's no real compensation in terms of the total biomass by smaller heterotrophs in the model as we remove the larger herbivores. And indeed, the metabolic rate, of the total ecosystem metabolic rate, doesn't respond either. So some interesting insights there, but also I'll totally admit with some caveats about what the model is capturing. And that takes me on to my next sort of area that I wanted to talk about, really, which is being completely open about the fact there are huge gaps in what the model does capture at the minute. I thought it might be interesting to reflect on the developments that I think would be really interesting from this land-sea interface. And the first is about the representation of prior reproduction. So on land, previously we've been representing, in the oceans, a big fun, we represented all phytoplankton as a single stock, so a big lump of biomass that could be eaten on. There was no size differentiation of it. Then we were corrected by plankton scientists who were pointing out there was a greater size range in plankton alone than there was in the sort of above plankton organisms in the ocean. But yes, so the models used following a sort of size-structured approach, as has been mentioned before. What we've introduced more recently is a size-differentiated phytoplankton and zooplankton scheme in the model. The point I wanted to make here is that, yes, the in the oceans, at least the pelagic ocean, the productivity is really coming in from the bottom, from the smallest organisms. But trophic changes at the top can feed back down to affect that size distribution, and warming or nutrient changes could impact from the bottom up. So it's an important thing to incorporate. But it's a stark difference from particularly forested systems, where the vertical structure introduces the effect that most of the production in that system is occurring above the floor. And I think one of the projects that we're involved in at the minute with colleagues at Northern Arizona University is to look at what's the effect of that structure, and in particular the fact that just the physical limits of tree structural properties means that large organisms can't reach the top of the areas where productivity is largest, can affect the size structure of ecosystems in those forests. And also to point out that the incorporation of fruit seems to be an important pull for what are the larger organisms, arboreal organisms, to move into trees. But I think there's an interesting point to make around comparing marine and terrestrial systems. And so do we need to compare analogous vertical structured systems as well as comparing well-mixed sort of flat systems? So, for example, would we compare savannas with shallow seas and vertically structured forest systems with deeper oceans? Another point which is we're busy working on at the minute is around ecological stoichiometry. And I think this, we've touched on this already, is critically important, I think, to account for difference in composition of organisms. And here's a plot from a nice paper, Angelica Gonzalez, and was published in 2017, showing the distinction between primary producers, invertebrates and vertebrates in terms of their stoichiometric composition. And we're just starting some work to incorporate stoichiometry explicitly in the model at present with collaborators at KIT. I think another area we're working on is this, what I broadly characterise as a below photic zone or a detrital system. So I think there's loads of scope to represent, in the, at least in the terrestrial realm, an analogous below ground ecosystem to that which is currently above ground. So an agent-based model coupled to some some differential equation-based model representation of below ground processes. I think this is critically important to capture, and essentially to close the systems that we were looking at, so that we can take into account some of the feedbacks which animals have on plants via nutrient cycling rates. But I'm interested, and I know I'd be interested in some thoughts on what the possible similarities between deep sea systems in the oceans, which are reliant on sinking from above, and below ground systems on land. Are there useful analogies to look at there? So another area I think is really important is, and I've used this term very broadly, is about organismal intelligence. As I said, intelligence writ large here. I think in general, intelligence behavior has this very strong stabilizing effect on ecosystems. And incorporating in that sort of the behavioral ecology that comes with these calling functions when incorporating predator-prey interactions, or indeed decision making around if there's resource limitations, do I go into hibernation or do I make some kind of long distance dispersal or other things like that? And to what extent we can incorporate learning behaviors into the model and pass those on between adults to their juveniles, etc. Another reflection that's come to our attention in the last few years is when is it that taxonomy is important? So it seemed to us appropriate we could throw away aspects of taxonomy to purely focus on ecosystem structure and function. But some ecological processes are profoundly influenced by taxonomy, for example, reproduction. And we had the collaboration with some Australian colleagues to think about how we could incorporate more biodiversity composition models with functional models to take that into account. I'm interested to know if there are other processes in the marine environment which might be dependent upon taxonomy. And lastly, in terms of those developments, I think is the a broad thing around data integration. I think integrating the model more formally with data using Bayesian approaches will be critically important for us, partly to drive objective model development to know which parts of the ecology are most uncertain, but also to allow us to sensibly incorporate more ecology, because there's so much ecology we could incorporate. What is it that actually seems important to put in there? To allow us to infer key processes and differences between ecosystems, and potentially other computational techniques through emulation to make more efficient simulations or more efficient comparisons of data. And I realize I should probably stop now because it's coming up to 6:30. Does that make sense to stop, Chris, at that point? I've got one slide, perhaps whilst you're coming to the screen, which was just to reflect on terrestrial marine linkages. So there have been strong ecological linkages linking marine terrestrial systems in the past. So megafauna provided this cycling of phosphorus from oceans and from the deep oceans, which through seabirds and anadromous fish and then riparian landscapes moved phosphorus from oceans through into terrestrial systems. That's been substantially altered by megafauna extinctions. And now I think the major linkages are through human-dominated activities, either through food sourcing or through nutrient impacts, which has impact for really high-level concepts like planetary boundaries. But a conscious of thanks. So with that, I'll skip to say thank you for the opportunity to talk, and happy to answer questions or discuss another time. It's a good question. I'm no way a plankton specialist. I mean, I think it depends on the question you're asking, right? I mean, if you're after general patterns, then you perhaps don't need as much complexity. If you're looking at a particular ecosystem, which has a great diversity of planktonic types, then perhaps you do need them. What we've found so far is actually the model seems somewhat realistic with a very simplistic plankton scheme. But when we try to capture some of these feedback effects, clearly we need more diversity and more. But I think, at least from my side, it's very much question dependent, I think.
I have an almost philosophical question about the whole approach. Because in the end, I mean, you identify the several areas of possible improvement, but it seems that it's almost infinite, you know, because you could always add more features. And so my question is really about how far we can go with this type of models in the absence of data or with insufficient data, because it seems to me that it's potentially infinite. And it was already the question that I had with the model initially, but it can become, you know, bigger and bigger, and I don't know where to stop, actually. So I'm not sure if you, I guess you have discussed about that, and you have some...
Yeah. No, I mean, I totally agree. I mean, ad absurdum, you end up with a model that is one-to-one relationship with the real world, and is ridiculous. So, I mean, I think, it comes down to what questions you want to address with it and whether it's sufficiently credible to do in silico experiments on. I think that's where its real value is. So you know, not wanting to talk on for too long because we're past our time. But that's why I think a kind of a formal data constrained approach with whatever data we can have is incredibly important, because we need some objective way to work out what bits of ecology we should put in and how complex they should be. So unlike, I can draw the analogy with climate models again, where we could just keep adding more and more complexity until the model's so unwieldy that, you know, it's hard to work with, and we don't know exactly what bit of, you know, do we need the seventh parameter in a particular functional form or a whole new ecological process in there. So I think starting now with some objective framework for that development is important. And I think just being open about what questions you might address with this kind of model versus a different modeling approach is important. I hope that addressed in some way your question.
Okay. Michel is silent, so he must be happy.
I think there can't be any perfect answer to that question. But I was just wondering about your, you know, the way you were approaching the issue. But I see that you want to take into account data availability and to continue to build your models. So I think that's important.
Yeah. Certainly a very interesting framework to explore, with actual data, the congruence between the model and the data. So thanks very much, Mike.